Hello, and welcome to the latest energy podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. My name is James Henderson, and I'm Director of the Gas Programme at OIES. Today, I'm here with Mikhail Maidan, who is an Associate Fellow at the Institute, but whose main role is as the lead analyst for Asian energy policies and geopolitics energy aspects, with a particular focus on China. It is this latter subject that we're going to discuss for around 25 minutes today, with a specific focus on the gas sector. Mikhail, thanks very much for being here. My first question, which I think is the question on most people's lips, is why Chinese gas demand has rebounded so robustly in the last few months, and what do you reckon the prospects are for the rest of this year and into 2018?
Good morning, Jim, and thanks for allowing me the opportunity to be on the OIES podcasts. China has indeed surprised to the upside in terms of both natural gas demand growth and LNG imports this year. It has been this stellar growth rate has been largely driven by policy. It was the government mandate to clean up the skies along sort of coastal China, mainly in the north, that has prompted this massive uptick this year. 4 years ago, the government issued a policy, an air pollution and control prevention program, that aimed to phase out all the coal-fired boilers in sort of four key hubs in China. Again, northern China, Beijing, Tianjin, Hebei, the Yangtze River Delta, the Pearl River Delta, to get rid of all the coal-fired boilers and replace them with natural gas. The deadline for this replacement was October 2017, and because this year it coincided with the Party Congress, which is a key political event, the push for implementation was very, very forceful. And so we've seen last year, but mainly this year, everybody gearing up for this switch. So that has been the main driver of gas demand growth this year. There have been a number of facilitators that have helped. The fact that local and provincial governments have issued subsidies and helped with a replacement program has, of course, contributed to the uptick in growth. But we've also seen a cut in domestic natural gas prices, even though that has taken effect in September. I mean, some would argue that there was another natural gas price cut back in late 2015, and that has gradually filtered its way down sort of through the industry and started to make an impact. But it has been this year's price cut and a very interesting innovation in the Chinese market, which has been more about dealing with infrastructure supply bottlenecks. The demand potential has always been there in China, but there's been an issue of getting the pipelines, building enough pipelines, making sure that all the users are connected. And this year we've seen a rise in LNG trucking. So not LNG for trucks in the transportation sector, but actually people trucking LNG from LNG import terminals to the end users. And that has managed to fill this infrastructure bottleneck gap. And at times, even during the summer, this trucked LNG has been competitive in terms of prices with pipeline gas. So that has really facilitated this uptick in natural gas demand growth. So in the year to date, we've seen 20% year-on-year. In the year to September, we've seen a 20% year-on-year increase in apparent demand for gas in China.
Well, thanks for that. Introductory answer. Lots to get our teeth into there, I think. I guess the first question I'd have was, I mean, you've mentioned coal-fired boilers as the main target initially, obviously, in the industrial sector largely, I guess, and the deadline for that being October this year. Is that going to be a continued driver of growth, or are we going to be looking at other sectors now? The power generation sector is obviously the one that everyone really focuses on, and I know that's been a bit of a laggard. What do you think about other sectors switching to gas?
I mean, the industrial sector really has been the driver this year. And my concern is that this is a one-off. So we've had this big increase this year, and that could add anywhere from 20 to 24 BCM of demand this year. Industry is the biggest consumer of natural gas in China. In 2016, it was estimated at around 100 BCM of 205 BCM of total consumption. So the uptick this year could be massive. But once these boilers are connected, the incremental growth rates are unlikely to be this steep next year. So you've got a bigger base of users, but the ability to connect more users at this kind of rate without a huge policy push, which is probably less likely going forward, is limited. So again, these eastal, the coastal regions have now made the switch. The extent to which policymakers will want to push this in central and western China, where air quality is less of an issue, where price sensitivity is higher, I think is limited. So we've had this massive uptick this year. And we do think that natural gas demand growth slows again in the coming years. And we're talking, you know, about 12% demand growth rather than 20% demand growth, but that is still a big deal for global gas markets. The other sectors are less, sort of, they're all policy sensitive in the sense that they rely on government signals and subsidies. But residential, sort of, demand growth in the residential sector continues. It has continued this year. It's probably roughly 5 BCM of demand growth, of additional demand this year. Those rates will continue because there's a big urbanization push, because environmental, the need to clean up the air and remains a top priority for the government. So residential growth will continue. But again, that's not the main driver of demand growth in China. The power sector has always been one where the West looks at China and expects the power sector to be the main driver of gas demand growth, and it's unlikely to be. The policy documents don't really talk about the power sector as the main area for, as the main focus, and the government does have a plan for natural gas in the power sector to go from 50 or 60 gigawatts of installed capacity in 2016 to 100 and even 110 in 2020. But we're still talking about installed capacity of 900 gigawatts currently in total. So gas is still a fraction of the power sector, and it will likely remain so because a lot of the coal-fired capacity is relatively new, because of the pricing differentials, because getting gas onto the grid is complicated, to say the least, and because increasingly we're going to have renewables competing with natural gas. So the power sector, yes, we will see more demand from the power sector, and it's already, I think, roughly 16 or 17% of total gas use, but it will stay roughly in that area, or maybe 18% of total gas demand. It's unlikely to see a massive uptick unless we get a severe change of, sort of, a big change of heart in the policy outlook. But again, we can't forget that the coal sector is a very important sector in China, and there's not going to be an overnight switch that will forego that sector and that will sort of that will you know, look to harm that sector.
So talking about policy, obviously we've just had the 19th Party Congress, and you know, one of the big political issues, it appears, is air quality and the environment, which gas can play a role in alleviating. Was there anything from the 19th Party Congress that stood out which might favour or otherwise the gas sector? And, you know, is the environment and the air quality issue still at the top of the agenda?
The environment and air quality are 100% at the top of the agenda. I think the most noteworthy things that emerged from the Party Congress were that the government, that the leadership has changed the focus in the constitution. They've basically changed the wording to say that growth is no longer the main target. It's no longer the Communist Party's main pursuit. It is delivering a better quality of life. And that includes the environment, it includes poverty alleviation, education, other things, but quality of life is significant, and the environment plays a major role in that. So certainly, we are now looking at a country that will remain committed to its environmental targets and will even sort of accelerate its efforts to deliver blue skies. We're seeing that already this winter. There have been a lot of targets that have been handed down to the provinces to reduce PM2.5, particulate matter in the air, to reduce emissions for this winter. And again, the gas push for this winter is one of those drivers, is one of those factors. But whether that plays specifically to gas or to gas and renewables, it's probably the latter. I mean, we are going to see more renewables, as I said, in the power sector. And gas will have a share of the energy mix, but we're talking about a share that goes from 6% in 2016 to 10% of the overall energy mix in 2020. And even that will be a challenge to achieve. I mean, the five-year plan that was laid out in 2016 had envisioned natural gas demand reaching 360 BCM by 2020. We're looking at a market of 205 BCM last year. Reaching that 360 BCM will be incredibly challenging, both from the demand and the supply perspectives.
So, you know, talking about those targets and what obstacles there are. You've mentioned pricing so far. There's obviously the issue of the kind of monopolies dominating the gas sector, and there's been talk about liberalisation. What would you say are the big obstacles to, you know, gas demand really accelerating in China, and do you see any kind of government initiatives to tackle those obstacles? I mean, let's start with pricing. How do you see the whole price regulation stroke liberalisation going over the next few years?
Price liberalisation has been, again, touted as one of the key priorities for the government, allowing markets to play a decisive role in the economy was even enshrined in the constitution. So again, these are prominent issues, and these reform items will continue to be pushed forward in the coming years. But I think we have to be careful when we talk about price liberalisation and reforms in the Chinese context. It isn't what we think of it here in the West as a complete sort of open market competition. First of all, the role of the state-owned enterprises remains a pillar role in the economy. The government has, it seems, very few plans to privatize these companies or to open the market completely. The idea, as perhaps contradictory as it may sound, is to have a very strong state sector and to make it stronger, more efficient, and perhaps even more competitive by introducing market prices or greater competition. But ultimately, the goal is to make the state-owned sector nimbler or more efficient or less wasteful. And what we're seeing in terms of price reforms is still government set prices, but that adapt much more quickly to market realities. I mean, in the oil sector, market prices track global oil prices. In the gas sector, they're sort of pegged to LPG and fuel oil prices, but the adjustments have so far been made once a year. So they track, in theory, they track global prices and domestic oil prices, but in reality, they have not been flexible enough, and they haven't been able to meet the movements in international prices and reflect those domestically. The other challenge, of course, on pricing is that the government has to take into account both the production side of things and the demand side of things. So prices have to be low enough to spur demand, but they also have to be high enough to incentivize the producers to develop domestic resources. And I think it's a running commentary, perhaps even a joke in China, that there is no such thing as cheap gas in China. If you can produce it in Sichuan or in Chongqing, and even if the costs there are relatively low, you then have to move it to the big consumer areas in eastern China, and the prices tend to rise as a result of that. So the pricing conundrum is a huge challenge for the government, but also remains one of the key reasons that it is probably not going to be left to the market alone. There are lots of experiments with gas on grass pricing, with a gas futures exchange, and sort of with various mechanisms that will better reflect the supply and the demand, and will allow the market to at least guide the resource allocation. But from here to actually letting go of all price setting, for the government to let go of all price setting, it seems like quite a distant leap that will likely be post 2020 at the very earliest.
Okay, well, you've led us quite nicely there into that kind of conundrum between supply and demand. On the supply side, clearly there's been growth in conventional gas supply, but also a lot of talk about shale and tight oil and also coal, but methane, unconventional gas. Targets don't really seem to have been met. I guess there's also been the conundrum of the state-owned enterprises and their interaction with international companies. How do you see the future of gas supply in China, both conventional and unconventional? And again, you know, price is one obstacle. Are there any others?
The state-owned monopoly has been, it seems to have been an obstacle to developing shale gas. I mean, the Chinese regulators have looked at the US experience, and they've experimented with opening up at least shale for competition. They've opened up acreage to private bidding. They've tried to replicate the American model, and that has not succeeded, to put it mildly. The shale acreage bidding turned out to be more of a land grab than an actual appetite for exploration. And the major shale production is still in the hands of Sinopec and its falling block in Sichuan province. The other issues that are hindering a lot of the private investors or even foreign companies has been A, the price signals, B, the access to pipelines, which is still dominated by the state-owned companies, and a lack of clarity about their rights and about where the gas market is developing going forward. So shale production has increased, and we're looking at around 6 BCM today from shale, which sort of for a country that had nothing 5-6 years ago is quite impressive. But from here to a 30 BCM target in 2020 still seems a little bit ambitious. Conventional production has really picked up again this year. We've seen year-to-date growth at around 9% year-on-year, with all of the majors focusing their capex very, very heavily on natural gas. If you look at their earnings reports, you see that even with limited capex, they've downscaled oil production. Oil production has declined by 3% year-on-year, but they focused very, very heavily on natural gas. And here, too, it's a function of government policy. The fact that demand has improved massively this year has helped, but the fact that the government has said we need more gas supplies has also contributed to this renewed enthusiasm for gas production. Now, whether the government target for 2020 is to reach 207 BCM of production, probably somewhere around 190, seems a bit more realistic. If we're looking at 7-8% year-on-year growth, that would be that would be consistent with what we've seen on average over the past few years, and would be a good sort of performance. The question then becomes, what happens if and when oil prices increase, and if there's a renewed appetite to shift again to oil production? Because the government is also guided towards higher oil production in China. Now, it doesn't seem likely that the majors will shift massively away from natural gas. It's not just the domestic demand growth, it's also when they look at the industry globally and they look at sort of where they can become increasingly competitive. It does look like natural gas, unconventional gas, is a good industrial choice for them, not just a good political choice domestically. I think the biggest open question for domestic production is coal-bed methane and the coal resources. These seem to go on and off and sort of turn hot and cold in China. If you look at it from sort of the past 10, 15 years, the government has had very high coal-bed methane production targets that have not been met. And every so often, local provinces, especially the coal-rich provinces, get very enthusiastic and they develop pilot programs with investors. And then Beijing turns around and says, well, actually, it's quite heavy on the emissions and a heavy, heavy consumer of water, which is also a scarce resource in China. And so they turn the taps off. It sounds like the government is a little bit more favorable towards coal to gas, mainly because there is a huge coal industry that provides employment and tax revenues that cannot be switched off overnight, and that the government doesn't want to switch off overnight because of the economic and social impact. So there is a lot of hesitation about how to put the coal industry best to use. And is it coal to gas? Is it coal to chemicals? But I think we'll see these fluctuations continue, and coal to gas will supply some of China's domestic demand, but it will not be the biggest source of demand growth, of supply growth going forward.
Okay, I mean, which leads us nicely to the key question, I guess, for the global gas industry, which is, you know, what's left over for imports, and how do the Chinese authorities think about, one, security of supply, given that there is increasing dependence on imports. Obviously, we've seen it in the oil sector, now we're starting to see it in the gas sector. And also how they view the kind of, if you like, the compass of imports they've got. I mean, what are they thinking about the balance between Central Asia, Russia, Myanmar, and of course LNG is the balancing item. What are your thoughts on the import outlook?
In this year, of course, we've seen LNG imports surge. And part of that was also to do with lower pipeline intakes. There was a sort of stoppage on the Uzbek pipeline for several months. It seems like there was a sort of government-to-government conflict there that slowed supplies. And so in the context of this very strong demand growth, LNG picked up very strongly and sort of supplied met the slack, if you will. And I think also anticipating that this winter we will have a strong uptick in demand because of the switch from coal-fired boilers, and when winter heating will be key. There was a massive push to increase storage capacity and to fill that storage. So that has also supported the intake of LNG. In terms of gas supply security, it hasn't been a prominent policy item yet. For oil, we've really seen the government try to cap oil imports, because we're also talking about a 60 to 65% dependency that has also created strategic vulnerabilities with maritime supply routes, and that sort of fits into some of the geopolitical concerns that China has vis-a-vis the US and its ability to cut off supplies. On natural gas, it's still a 30% supply dependency, import dependency, but so far it's been roughly, it's been shared pretty much evenly between pipelines and LNG imports. So there's been a land-based supply option that again seems less vulnerable, at least to the government. So there haven't been any indications of an effort to cap import dependency. Implicitly, the push to develop domestic resources, including shale gas, is an attempt to at least hedge against over-reliance on imports. But with gas prices being where they are and sort of a relatively diversified portfolio in terms of the Chinese imports, the government doesn't seem to be overly concerned, and actually is adopting a more sanguine outlook and actually trying to promote a greater Chinese presence in not just in sort of shipping resources, sort of for Chinese companies to ship the resources themselves, but also to be more active in trading and in price making. So there is a recognition that China will import and that it is a big part of the global gas system, and it should therefore become more active throughout the supply chain and as a price maker rather than a price taker. But the import dependency, and I think there we are going to see a relatively even split between pipelines and LNG. And this also dovetails with the competition between the major gas importers, where CNOOC has invested heavily in a natural gas and an LNG portfolio. CNPC is investing heavily in pipelines. And Sinopec is doing a bit of both, a lot of domestic upstream, and then getting into the LNG game increasingly. But we do see, this year we expect LNG takes to increase by roughly 12 BCM year on year, a volume that should slow next year to sort of 8 to 10 BCM. Still a sizable chunk of the global gas market, but a slowdown compared to this year's increments. Pipeline takes, we've seen Kazakhstan start a new pipeline, and they're talking about 5 BCM a year. It will probably take time for that pipeline to ramp up to full capacity. And of course, the big question is the Power of Siberia pipeline and when that starts.
I mean, on that issue, there's obviously been a lot of dialogue recently between the Russians and the Chinese, and the sort of setting of a firm date in December 2019 when supplies are going to start, and also talk about a Far East pipeline from Sakhalin, as well as the ongoing discussion about the Altai pipeline in the West. What do you think about the relationship between China and Russia around gas? Clearly, there's a reasonably significant oil relationship, but on gas it's taken a long time to get things going. Are you confident that in the 2020s we're going to see a significant ramp up of Russian gas to China, or do you think it's going to be another slow burner?
I mean, the gas relationship, as you mentioned, has been very fraught, and it's been perhaps more due to timing and the situation of the market rather than geopolitics up until 2014, up until the time when they signed the Power of Siberia. I think the lengthy negotiations were just due to very different expectations, both of the Chinese expecting gas demand to grow massively and then look to Russia as a supply option, whereas Russia was looking to Europe. And then when gas demand growth in China slowed, the Russians were actually ready to talk to the Chinese, but at that point, the urgency for the Chinese seemed less acute. I think in 2014, issues converged, and that was mainly because of the geopolitics, because of Russia's growing international isolation, and because China's outlook, I think, on geopolitics and on the regional balance of powers was looking a bit more delicate. But they came together and they signed the deal. It is likely to start up as they say, in 2020. The question is the volumes. I think that's the biggest question. How quickly can they ramp up to 38 BCM? I mean, for the Chinese, the power of Siberia is important in that it meets the needs of a captive market in northeast China. Got three provinces, Liaoning, Jilin, Heilongjiang, that really need winter supplies, especially winter supplies, and don't really have a good alternative. There's one LNG terminal in Liaoning province, but that's about it. But these three provinces consume, say, 12 BCM, maybe 15 BCM, and again, it's very peaky, it's very seasonal. So what happens to the other, to the additional 20 to 25 BCM? That has to be transported to the eastern coast, where there is already a lot of competition from imported LNG, and increasingly from the domestic supplies. And now that we're seeing trucked LNG that is filling in these gaps, it is becoming harder to compete with the various supply options. So it seems like a 38 BCM supply will take quite a long time to materialize. And again, also because of this uncertain outlook for natural gas in China, if the industrial demand growth has pretty much reached its peak, and even the government talks about industrial demand going from 47 or 48% of gas use to roughly 40% of gas use in 2020 and peaking, and a limited uptick in the power sector, some demand growth in the transportation sector, is all this gas actually needed? So I think any additional pipelines are very, very hard to envisage at this point in time, unless, of course, the Russians give a huge price concession. And then of course, it's a completely different deal. But there doesn't seem to be too much appetite for price concessions. And I think the Russians have been slightly disappointed by the Chinese in 2014 when they signed the Power of Siberia deal and a lot of other oil-related deals. I think they were hoping for a lot of Chinese financing to come into Russia, and for the Chinese to be much more supportive financially, whereas the Chinese were quite cautious about any investments that would not make a good return, be it sort of political or actual financial return. So I think there's a little bit more caution on both sides towards engaging even more heavily and being overly reliant one on the other.
Okay, well, I just looked at my watch and time has flown by. Our 25 minutes is up, so I'll conclude the podcast by thanking Mikhail for some fascinating answers and for your time. And just to tell listeners that you can find other podcasts on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org under the multimedia tab. But for now, I will conclude this podcast. And again, thank you, Mikhail, for your time.